The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Dreamers, Winners, and Making a Difference with Michael Friedlander. Michael is an international business lawyer and consultant who has also been the CEO of three international companies. Michael has also written three books, one of which is about how Nelson Mandela realized his own dreams to become an iconic winner who saved a nation. In today's show, join Michael in a conversation with his guest, a winner who has also made a difference for the better in the lives of those he or she has touched. Michael and his guest will offer some insight that might well help you realize your own dreams. Now, here is your host, Michael Friedlander.
Hi, I am Michael Friedlander, and welcome to our show. I'm really delighted to have Kristen Ekel here with me today. In past shows, other guests have mentioned to me what an important role meditation and yoga plays in their lives, but when they did, I didn't quite know what to say. For starters, I know diddly squat, which, for those of you who don't understand South African English, means nothing. I know diddly squat about either meditation or yoga. Sadly, my bones and joints are the stiffest in the kingdom, and I couldn't imagine my body in a typical yoga position. My body just doesn't move in those directions. And as for the swamis that come part of most yoga and meditation packages, I find their names totally unpronounceable. And as for their chanting, which is supposed to, I believe, make you more tranquil and calm, instead of doing that, it makes me sometimes mildly suicidal. Perhaps this might explain why I've never really pursued either yoga or meditation with any great enthusiasm. So this is the background to me asking Kristen to join us today. She is a meditation and yoga specialist, but she's also truly interesting and very smart, and brave, incidentally. I don't yet know if she realizes quite the challenge that chatting with me represents, but if she can sway me into accepting some form of meditation, I will nominate her for whatever available prize there is out there. So I have promised to keep an open mind, and I will. With all this in mind, I've decided to call today's show That Yoga and Meditation Thing, A Key to the Door. Thinking about how I might introduce Kristen, I figured I should let her do that mainly, but let me just say this. In my next life, I intend to come back a male version of Kristen, and this is how I'm going to come back. I'm going to come back tall and smart with a great sense of humor. I want to be the male equivalent of gorgeous, which is what she is. Like her, I want to be a famous international fashion model and a successful network television host. I want to be spiritual. I want to be able to touch my toes without groaning. And more important than anything, I want to be able to wrap both my legs around my neck and scratch my nose with either big toe. So that's what I want to be when I return. You think I'm aiming a little too high, Kristen?
I think that you can actually be pretty much anything you set your sights to with enough practice.
Even tall.
You can get taller. Yeah, well, they have lifts. I wear fabulous shoes. I get 6'2" when I'm in those.
Oh, really? I should try those. Anyway, thanks for coming on the show. It's really great. I admire your courage. You're the first person of the female species who's had the courage to accept an invitation to join me. And what I'm hoping for after the show is that I'll be swamped with invitations and pleas and requests and demands from others of your species to join me too. So you are going to be a trailblazer.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's not my first time being a trailblazer, and yet I am always honored to hold the machete.
That's great. I was thinking of telling the folks how we met, but I thought we should keep that as a secret, right?
That sounds so clandestine and mysterious. Why not?
Okay, I thought what we do now is do what we've done with our other guests, which is for me to ask them to articulate their dreams, to talk about who helped them realize their dreams, and to talk about how they believe they have made a difference for the better in the lives of those they've touched. But more particularly as well, I think this would be a great opportunity for you to tell the folks how you've got to where you are, what your background is, and what you've done. So you want to go for it.
I would be honored to. Thank you so much. First of all, thank you very much for having me on. It is always an honor and a privilege to speak to any audience, because I really do believe that us just having the courage to open our mouth and speak what we believe to be true is in and of itself a gift and a blessing. And no matter what the message happens to be, there is somebody out there who needs to hear it. And if we do not speak up, then everybody will be robbed of the opportunity. So thank you for creating this opportunity. It's my pleasure to be here. You know, I grew up, I graduated high school in the 80s. I was very much a normal kid in that sense. I wanted to grow up and go to college and become a veterinarian. I'd always been interested in healing and animals, and that was always a bent of mine. I also very much had a father who was, on some level, kind of a mystic. My dad would discuss with me about the building of Cheops Pyramid and the ley lines and the airport lines of Nazca, Peru, and all these very sort of mysterious Earth mysteries that we'd had on the planet, and how things happen, and alien communication. And so that was one side of my upbringing right there that I think was always important to me, to be fascinated and intrigued and interested about something else out there. And as a young girl going to school, learning to finally find her way to put herself through college, I became a model as a way in Tucson, Arizona to pay for college, basically. And so at 16, I started doing little modeling jobs here, there, and everywhere. I'd been a beauty queen at 12 and had done beauty pageants. But beauty pageants are very expensive. And after winning the crown in 1980 and kind of going that route, I said, you know what, I would rather be paid to do this instead of paying people to have this happen to me. So modeling became a way to kind of put some money aside for college. And when I was a freshman in college, my freshman year, I found out there was going to be a giant modeling competition in New York. And so I quit school. I worked my butt off, saved every penny I could, and went to New York for this huge modeling competition, which I came in second overall and first in the commercial division, and got a contract to go to Tokyo. And so, you know, at 18 years old, flying to Tokyo to start your career, I mean, I never guessed in a million years that would be the trajectory of my life. That was not what I'd planned for. That's not what I grew up expecting. It was never a dream of mine. It was what was laid before me. And as a result of coming into my own as a young teenager and as a young woman in the world of modeling and going to Paris and you know, working in London and Milan and really traveling the world for this giant chunk of my life, it hugely informed me and it shaped me. And the idea of going back to college to become a veterinarian went out the window after a couple of years. There was no question of my not continuing the trajectory of what I had done. And it really began to speak to me. So in this course of a great deal of work, a lot of money, it's late 80s in Paris, it was sex, drugs, and rock and roll all the way, I began to find myself getting really burned out and feeling very much, on some level, the meat market aspect of the work and having to protect myself in all of this. And so eventually I began doing yoga as a way to capture myself, as a way to recapture myself. Up until then, my body was a commodity that everyone else was capturing. My image, my voice, my likeness, my performance was judged and evaluated before I even walked in the room. And I was held to a standard of perfection that was, you know, it's kind of difficult to maintain perfection every single day.
Yeah,
and it's unrealistic.
I have the same experience.
Well, clearly, I know, and it's really something that's challenging for most people. And you know, in the 80s, we didn't have you know, Photoshop. You had to look like that, or you didn't come back to work the next day. So there was this drive for an outward appearance of what beauty or perception of what that accessibility would mean. You know, got millions of dollars riding on that image, right? So yoga became this fantastic way for me to reclaim and discover myself and to really begin to see myself for the first time. And as a result of my beginning practice, my burgeoning practice, my first teacher was a book, actually, I decided to leave Paris and migrated to New York, where I now felt like a complete fish out of water. And that really began the emergence of my spiritual practice. I began to study yoga more in-depthly with a great number of teachers, traveled the world with a great number of teachers.
Kristen, were you still modeling then?
I was. When I was living in New York, I was still commuting basically to Paris. So I was back and forth between the two. But on the down times when I didn't have to be on a plane or on a shoot, I would take classes, I would go to retreats. But that being said, I did begin studying with a variety of teachers, and I began studying North and South American shamanism. And I felt as if this sort of soul language that I'd always felt but had never spoken, had never been given to me, I suddenly was given a dictionary to. And I just ate it up. I learned everything. I became a Reiki practitioner. I'm now an Usui and Karuna Holy Fire Reiki master. And I also began my journey into hypnotherapy, and I've been a certified hypnotherapist since 1991. And so those things were in tandem to the modeling and then later into the television career. And I thank God for it, because it wasn't as if I did them with the anticipation of them being my career. I did them as a way to keep myself sane and as a way to offer some small nurturance or support along the way whenever it became necessary. But it was never what I thought I was going to actually do. And so fast forward a bunch of years, I'm now living in Los Angeles. I've been here for going on 15 years, which is shocking in and of itself. Mother of two children, single now. And I began recapturing these parts of myself that had sort of lying dormant. And in doing so, it wasn't as if I went back to that person in her 20s learning these things. It was as if that person in the 20s had ripened and evolved to now this woman in her 40s, evolving this new language and pulling these parts together in this completely different amalgam that I had not anticipated when I was beginning the journey. So now my practice has become much more prevalent for me. I weave it into my life in a much more open way. It's kind of like I've come out of the spiritual closet, if you will.
Can I interrupt you 1 second? So was one of your dreams to rediscover yourself, essentially?
I would say that the dream of self-discovery has bubbled up to the extent that it was completely unavoidable. I didn't know that that was my dream until it became inescapable that something was missing. And that has been really the great purpose in choosing to recapture, not just for myself, but hold that door open for other people, that they can also realize their dream. And this goes to your question of what is it that I give back to the world? I don't do any healing or anything for anybody. I just simply use the tools and the education I've been privy to hold open a doorway to allow you or anybody else to walk through, to have your own discovery of yourself. Because we all have those dreams. We all have these places where we lie dormant and where we're over the edge and need to be reeled back in. And we oftentimes have the keys to our own understanding within ourselves. We just need someone else to hold that ground. As I call it, holding space. I hold space for people to discover themselves.
And who introduced you to yoga?
My dear friend Carmen was another model. She actually was basically me in Milan. And she came to Paris as she was kind of in a similar place in her life, getting, you know, ready to change gears and saying, okay, this is clearly not working for me. And she gave me the book of yoga, I will say for my birthday, but I don't really remember why she gave it to me, except that her voice within clearly said, Kristen needs this book.
Okay. So let me begin my exploration with you into the as yet unknown world of meditation, unknown for me, by asking you a couple of questions. Firstly, is it possible to meditate without having to go through the dogma to chant and to hum and to do all this other stuff that a lot of people do, stare at candles? And is it possible to meditate without even realizing that you're meditating?
I actually believe it is. I think meditation is a normal state of awareness, much as alertness or sleepiness or any other mental state that we can be into. I liken it to that place where your body is completely relaxed, and yet your mind is alert and vibrant. So if you were to imagine that place, like if you were to take a big nap, and it's 2 p.m, and you don't have anywhere you have to be for the next 30 minutes, and you just deeply relax, you lie down in the bed, and it feels really great to just let it all go. And then about 10 minutes in, the phone rings in the other room. Now, you know that you can clearly get up and go answer the phone if you wanted to. And yet that voice in your head says, you know what, it's so great to just stay here and relax. Just let it go to voicemail. And so you do so. And while you're in that hyper-relaxed state, you get these images or thoughts or feelings, or you make a connection, or an awareness becomes prevalent for you. That is the brainwave state that allows for meditation to occur. So meditation, if you think of meditation as a brain state instead of an activity, it might help you to realize that you probably have been there many, many times.
So it's about balance then, really, huh?
Yes, it is about shifting your attention away from one state to another state. So it's about shifting your attention away from the fact that you are cold or you're sleepy or that this really sucks into the other aspect, that higher aspect, which says, yes, it's cold. However, this is what I need to go through in order to get to that other place. I need to be in this state in order to learn something, have a higher perspective. Oftentimes we'll come to something that looks fearful or terrifying even. And when we take a breath and we stand back for just a moment and we reassess without judgment, we then have another capacity to go within and come back to that problem without it being quite so terrifying. Usually we're more afraid of the fear than we are of the actual doing it itself. We know that meditation, that brainwave state of meditation, actually causes the body to release different hormones and chemicals that actually balance and heal the body, which is why if you don't get a good night's sleep, you become ill over the course of time. There's a reason why sleep deprivation is a form of torture. It is important for your body to have that off switch occur. And when it does, it allows for a hyper state of activity in the mind to go to a different plane. When you're in that different plane, you have problem-solving capacities that you don't have access to when you're in the muck. Albert Einstein had said, you cannot solve a problem at the level of the problem. And he would often use his images from dreams and meditative state in order to find incredible solutions, clearly, to difficulties that he was having in navigating some problem on his desk.
So when people talk about yoga and meditation, is it just different sides of the same coin?
They are different threads in the same sweater. We'll say that.
How does a sweater differ from a coin?
It's cozier. I'd rather wear a sweater. I'm all about the cozy. I'm much more about the cozy. Yeah,
I'm more about the coin, actually.
Well, you know, it takes both, right? You need the coin to get the sweater. So meditation can be a mental activity without a physical component. Yoga can be a physical component without the meditation. Both are separate if you choose them to be so. Some people use yoga as a calisthenic aerobic exercise, which it is not intended to be. I teach yoga for many years now, and I tell people, you know, I don't care if you have yoga booty or six-pack abs. I don't care. That's not what I'm teaching you. I am not teaching you how to do a one-armed handstand to wow your neighbors. I don't care. What I care about is the lessons and the principles that you learn about yourself on that little rubber mat for the 1 hour you're with me, so that you can utilize them for the next 23 hours off the mat in the rest of your life. That is what yoga does. Yoga is not about squeezing the organs and detoxifying the lymph gland and having fantastic muscle tone if you are also a raging bitch. It's not the point.
Okay, well, you've now answered my next question, because the other thing that I found was a quote that went something like this. He said, practicing yoga is a privilege, and with this privilege comes a duty to be kind, to share a smile, and to offer the yoga from the mat into the rest of your life. So that's just what you've said, right?
Yes, I've never read that quote, but it is exactly that, because yoga is the balancing of opposites. So the original word of yoga means, we've heard this before, union or yoking. So think about two oxen who are yoked together with that big heavy collar that they wear still in Sri Lanka, for example. And the two of them yoked together can pull a much heavier load than one on its own. The yoga is not the oxen, and it is not the power that pulls it. The yoga itself is that wooden loop around their necks that they lean into that allows them to move the heavy load.
You know, that was really good. Have you thought about doing this for a living?
Once or twice.
Yeah. Well, it seems, Kristen, the segment is just about done. But I'm looking forward to continuing our voyage of discovery into the world of meditation with you. Stay tuned.
Stimulating talk
gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
Tune in to Patricia Raskin Positive Living on VoiceAmerica.com every Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time and 11 a.m. Pacific Time. This program brings you practical and inspiring principles for living a more authentic, engaging, and passionate life. Patricia's guests will give you a formula for connecting, giving, forgiving, and miraculous living. So tune in and call in to Patricia Raskin Positive Living Mondays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time and 11 a.m. Pacific Time right here on the Voice America Variety Channel. It's practical, positive solutions for a happy, empowered, and successful life.
What can you find on Get Real Radio? Well, quite honestly, who you really are. Join host James Robinson each week for a program designed to reveal more about yourself and your world through words of wisdom and profound guests. You'll discover more about the spiritual movement and how it can work with you and alert you to problems you may not be aware of. It will educate, titillate, and enlighten your mind. Get Real Radio is broadcast live every Friday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. This could end up being the best time of your week.
Families today face unique challenges. Marriage, parenting, and family forms have changed a lot in the last century. Family Matters with Dr. Virginia Collin will focus on building and maintaining healthy family relationships. We will discuss marriage, divorce, family mediation, parenting, lifestyles, and mental health, all kinds of family matters. Our show will feature guest experts and your participation, too. You can listen to Family Matters live every Tuesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific on Voice America Variety.
We're making it easier to listen to the Voice America Talk Radio Network live wherever you go on iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android. Download it from the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
You are listening to Dreamers, Winners, and Making a Difference with Michael Friedlander. To find out more about our program, please visit www.dreamersandwinners.com. Now, back to this week's program.
Okay, we're back. I'm happy to say we have Kristen still with us.
And we're going to keep talking about meditation and yoga.
So, again, I found another quote, and this is what I read. Buddha was asked, "What have you gained from meditation?" He replied, "Nothing."
Mm-hmm.
However, Buddha said, "Let me tell you what I lost. Anger, anxiety, depression, insecurity, fear of old age and death." This sort of relates back to our show last week in which I interviewed Dr. Arash Asher, who's the director of cancer survivorship and rehabilitation at the Cedars-Sinai Medical Center here in Los Angeles. And he told me about the role that meditation and yoga plays in the lives of cancer patients and their families. Would you like to talk about this a little?
Absolutely. It's really quite profound that you, it's funny, you do gain nothing. That state of nothing, no thing, actually becomes really quite profound when you allow yourself to go into that. One of the ways that the reason I actually became a yoga teacher in the first place, not just a yoga practitioner, was because I had both of my children at home using yoga and hypnosis and self-hypnosis for labor. And what I discovered about the resourcefulness and the wherewithal that my physical body had as its resource to deal with such intensity was remarkable. And I thought, you know what, I'm not magic. If I can do this, anybody can do this. And when you're dealing with deep pain, deep depression, chronic loss, I work with people with PTSD and chronic pain due to autoimmune or a variety of other things. You've got to find a way to cope and live your life. You cannot just be sucking on the pipe and sleeping on the sofa all day long. You must, at some level, stand up and learn yourself through the crisis that this pain offers you, that this challenge offers you. You become yourself in the midst of this. That's what I said. You bring whatever it is onto the mat with you. Your pain, your depression, your suffering, your anger, your joy. And you find as you overcome that they are not the thing that stops you. It is your mental capacity to overcome whatever it is in your choice of how you choose to perceive things that is what gets you up and moving. And that's really all we have. I think you mentioned that on your last show, and I think that's really very true and profound, and yet people think, yeah, okay, but it still really hurts. I'm like, yeah, it does still really hurt. Of course it hurts. It's pain. However, You can suffer over your suffering, and you make it even worse. And when you give yourself tools and resources to alleviate that by elevating yourself with meditation, literally changing your brainwaves, changing the frequency that your body... And so yoga is not about finding balance by standing on one leg. It is about having the one leg find the balance, because the left and the right, the up and the down, the outer and the inner are so pulling in these opposite directions that balance happens effortlessly. And that's the trick. If you're struggling and grinding yourself into a posture, then you haven't found the balance. And the balance is not about muscling your way through. It's about melting and surrendering and allowing your body to discover where its balance is today. And I will guarantee you, Michael, that if you come to yoga jet-lagged, over-caffeinated, and with a hangover, you're going to have a very different experience than if you come to it on a Thursday, we've had a great night's sleep, and you've just been proposed to. Your emotional state,
Don't push this too far.
Well, I won't push you too far, trust me. But you will always bring wherever you are to the mat. You cannot divorce yourself from wherever you are. You have to always be there.
No, I get it. I get it, totally.
I know you do.
So in the context of what the show is about, where people are trying to realize their dreams and fulfill their potential, what you're talking about really is a means of obtaining some equilibrium to help them move on, right?
Absolutely. It is a tool in the tool chest, among other things. I have a bunch of tools in my tool chest because, you know, if you only have a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? So you need to have a variety of opportunities to give yourself to overcome whatever's in front of you, whether that is connection to your breath, whether that is a unbending will, as my teacher Yogi Bhajan, who's the spiritual head at this point, because he's passed on, of Kundalini Yoga in the West, he would say you need to have grit, you need to have stamina. And without those, you become sort of a slave to the willy-nilly, oh, I'll have a muffin now. You know, you just become like completely undisciplined. And you need to become very disciplined if you wish to move the hurdles in your life. Otherwise, you become subject to the tidal wave instead of moving and floating over the tidal wave.
Got it. It seems to me that what you're talking about is getting into a mental state where you can remove or eliminate or repress the anxiety that will allow you to keep going, right?
Yeah, I would say instead of repress, it's more about that you remove the necessity for an anxiety to be there. Anxiety is generally a state of energy that's looking to avoid a certain circumstance. So you're not anxious because something's going on. You're anxious because you're concerned about something that might go on. So you're anxious before it even happens, right? Or you're anxious because you had a certain history with something and you're afraid of it repeating into the future. So anxiety is about something that's not actually here with you in the moment. It's about a perceived concept of something that might possibly happen to you. And that's what anxiety is. So when you can be in the moment, in the presence, so let's say you're doing a particularly challenging yoga class and you have no room for anxiety because you're so here right now, you can't be anywhere other than this. Or you're in a particularly beautiful guided meditation that takes you out of that state of anxiety and brings you so present to your breath and so present to your body, there's no room for anxiety. It's like it gets pushed out. And the more frequently you give yourself those identification markers with the present moment, the less you begin to identify with anxiety in that space. It's like you take and you move that marker that anxiety used to inhabit somewhere outside of your energetic field.
Well, let's talk about that for a little bit, because in my experience, you know, I don't know whether it was Aristotle or Socrates or somebody said that true knowledge is knowing what you don't know.
Mm.
And I think Bertrand Russell may have said, or somebody like him said, that, you know, the wonderful thing about fundamentalists and extremists is that they have no doubt. They have total certainty, whereas the really smart folks live in a state of doubt. And when I think of anxiety, I think of the natural state of self-doubt that we all have, because I think you have to. I don't know how you can exist being totally certain of everything. And when I think of anxiety, I'm thinking about that natural state of self-doubt that I think everybody has. And I don't think you can ever eliminate it. It never goes away. The question is how you handle it. And when I think of meditation, it just strikes me that it's a way of handling it.
It certainly can handle it. I think something else, however. Yes, we have layers of self-doubt or self-consciousness or of not really being comfortable in our skin. That's what we're talking about. And some varieties within different people have different experiences, but it comes down to that. I'm not really comfortable that what I might say might be the right answer. I'm concerned that you might judge me. I'm concerned that I will fail. Something along those lines is generally what causes us to feel anxious or self-conscious or self-doubt. When we need to scout among our friends to find 14 different opinions to know what we feel, right? That's because we're not aligned with knowing that, no, I really do believe that I don't like mushrooms. I don't need to ask your opinion if I like mushrooms. I'm clear I do not like mushrooms. When it comes down to knowing of yourself, you then no longer have the anxiety about yourself within relationship to other people because you're so clearly always yourself. You don't need to be anything. You don't need approval. You don't need their judgment. You don't need to show up and be anything. You're just really honest. That's what I mean about coming out of the closet. If you're always telling the truth about who you are, you don't have to worry about the lies you've told because it's exhausting. You just be yourself. Now, you can edit yourself and be the polite, kind version of yourself. I'm not saying to be nasty. Whenever we are, well, I'm just telling the truth and sometimes the truth hurts, that's because we are making a choice based upon our ego to drive a point home. And that's not in that sense of truly owning yourself. That's about control and domination, and that's the other side of that coin. I'm just referring to simply in and of yourself, without the context of another person around, feeling comfortable in yourself of like, yes, I love wearing blue. Nope, I don't like eating mushrooms. And yes, I'll have 14 of those.
So I'd like to just explore, again, this connection between yoga and meditation, because I think I get it, but I'm not sure. Okay, so as I understand it, meditation is the process by which you work with your mind to attain some kind of equilibrium. And yoga is a process which you're working with your body that helps you get your mind into that state. Is that right?
They actually do very much work together like that in many ways, but you can also have the movement become the meditation. So, for example, in Kundalini yoga, we will do certain, they're called kriyas, which is a process, a series of different physical postures where you hold your eye, called drishti. You can hold your eyes rolled upwards and inwards, or focusing on the tip of your nose, or looking to the infinite space, or a variety, looking through the tip of your chin. You then also do mudras, with where you touch your fingers to one another, or how you hold your hands. And then you combine that with certain breath postures called pranayama, with mantra, which is that sound current of repetition of holy words or sentences or ideas or concepts or feelings. And then you do all of it over and over and over again. And you're thinking, gosh, I've got my arms above my head. I'm flapping my fingertips. I'm jumping up and down on one foot. I'm saying this kooky thing. Like, what the heck? Then what happens is, as a result of doing that and doing that for, 11 minutes, for example, you then find that something opens up inside of you that you could not quantify before. And it's not the hopping up and down on one foot and the flapping of the fingers. It's something else that opens up that physical energy allows you access to that you could only get as a result of that position. There's actually a book that I read many, many years ago. There was an anthropologist, and I don't remember her name right now, but she had a book called Ecstatic Body Postures. And I love this book because she and her archaeology students would unearth all of these little sculptures and pre-Columbian artifacts that would show people, these Aztec-looking people, in different physical positions, with sitting like this, or their tongue stuck out, or their eyes rolled over here, or doing these, mudras, as we would call them in the Indian language for the yoga work. And yet, she would have herself and her students do these postures, and they would all report similar characteristics of experience. The brain waves would change as a result of touching this part of the body to that part of the body, sticking the tongue out and doing breath of fire, for example. It changes how you feel. And when you change that, you then have an access to another point in your mind that opens up some awareness. And it is not a joke, Michael, the number of times people break down in tears in class with me. And it's not because what we're doing is so painful. It's because they're opening an access point into themselves that had been locked away. And that particular combination of breath work and mantra and mudra and movement of asana, the physical movement, had opened up something that they didn't have access to before. Deeper than psychotherapy, deeper than they even would have guessed for. So you can use the moving meditation as a way to connect to something that's bigger than yourself, which is why yoga is actually a science and not a religion. For many, many times here at my home studio space, I do what's called sadhana, which is a daily devotional meditation practice. And in Kundalini yoga, You're supposed to get up and do this sadhana between 4:15 and 6:15 every morning and have that be the opportunity for you to, as you said, listen. And it's because, not just because it's dark and it's quiet, which it's true, but it's also because that the sun comes into the earth at a 60-degree angle and affects your pituitary pineal gland, allowing you to awaken to those centers to have an easier access to listen with. So it's an actual science in terms of that. Beyond that, however, when you get up and do your meditation practice at 5 a.m. every day, you find that you actually gain energy in the day, that you're not frittering it away in negativity and painfulness and whatever, that doing that meditative practice at the early hour of the day actually affords you more energy than that 45 minutes of sleep would. And it's crazy, but it's true. So it's almost as if giving up that 45 minutes of sleep actually gives you so many more benefits throughout the course of the day in terms of productivity and emotional stability. As well, what happens is you begin to gain a measure of self-confidence and all that other stuff that we're talking about in terms of benefit, but it becomes also a sense of discipline. And this is the other part of meditation and yoga that I think people like to gloss over, but you need to be disciplined. And many of us are undisciplined. We have this monkey mind which leaps about from one pleasure to the next pleasure. And I'm not talking about a sense of deprivation. I'm talking about the sense of enjoyment that comes when you have self-mastery. And self-mastery is something that you earn. You do. It's not given to you. You must get up. You must work your way through your fears, your traumas, your ego instabilities, and earn self-mastery. That's what you get by giving yourself a daily ritual and practice. It's great if you go to yoga once a month. Awesome if you're going to eat once a month. But you need to do the daily meditative practice and keep being in the mindfulness of your life. Otherwise, it gets really easy to slip into the ego and slip into the daily hubris of things.
It seems like we're fast approaching the end of the segment, but let me make just a few observations as sort of a segue into the last segment. Firstly, you've done an absolutely terrific job for me in separating the destination from the journey when it comes to this whole meditation shtick. It seems to me that the destination or the goal of meditation is to reach a form of equilibrium, if you like, or balance or whatever, that'll give you a sense of tranquility to be able to cope better with life's challenges. So based on what I've heard, then this destination never changes. It also seems to me that how you get there, your journey, is just another question completely. Maybe the dogma works for some, maybe the swamis do inspire some, but as I understand it, you get to your how you get to your destination is far less important than just getting there. So what I'd like for us to talk about in the last segment are two broad areas. Firstly, I'm really interested in how, after reaching your destination, you actually make decisions and live your life. And then I'd like to end by completing the circle and talking about how you really can meditate without perhaps even realizing it and perhaps without the dogma. So please stay tuned.
The Internet's number one talk station.
Number one talk station.
VoiceAmerica.com.
There are over 140 million products manufactured worldwide. It is impossible to know the ingredients in these products, especially those made overseas. Stan Salat, creator of the HSF Mark and the Counterfeit Mark Alliance, is the host of People to People, working together for your safety. Stan believes in our right to know the type and amount of hazardous materials in consumer products and whether they are counterfeit. Find out how you can protect yourself every Tuesday at 2 p.m. Pacific Time, 5 p.m. Eastern on Voice America Variety.
Ah, a nice glass of wine is very refreshing after the end of a long day. But have you ever considered the story behind the wine? Tune in to Bacchus and Beery Wine Radio with your hosts, Roger and Donna Beery. You'll meet some of the people behind the world's wineries, travel the wine country, and learn more about that glass that you're enjoying. Roger and Donna will also give would-be vintners a behind-the-scenes look at starting a winery. Bacchus and Beery Wine Radio airs live every Friday at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on Voice America Variety.
It's time to take a new look at some of life's changing moments. It's time to listen to an expert who has been there and can provide insight through experience, studies, and enlightening guests. Tune in to Illuminating Now, Lindsay's Life Secrets. Host Lindsay Levinson takes a look at relationships, parenting, health and wellness, divorce, depression, sexuality, philanthropy, and mental health. You'll look at everything you know in a different way. Illuminating Now, Lindsay's Life Secrets, airs Wednesdays at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern on Voice America Variety.
Follow us on Twitter at Voice America TRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's Voice America TRN.
You are listening to Dreamers, Winners, and Making a Difference with Michael Friedlander. To find out more about our program, please visit www.dreamersandwinners.com. Now, back to this week's program.
Hi, we're back. This is the third segment. I still have Kristen with me. And Kristen, I'd like to talk a little bit about your approach to life after you have found what you found through meditation and yoga. So, let's get going.
I, coming from being a model for many, many years, professionally wore clothing. I now can look at a closet full of clothing and say, I'll wear this, I'll wear that, I'll wear this, and I can put it on. If I have to think more than 2 seconds about whether this outfit works or not, it's gone. I don't want to have to say, does this make me look fat? Or is this color work for me? I don't want to have to be there. I know right away, because I know my body and I know what works for me, if it works or it doesn't. If it's a second of a question, it's gone. And that's what I try to apply to everything else. If I go to a restaurant and I look at the menu, the first thing that pops out at me, that's what I order. Because invariably, it's delicious. I've rarely had anything that's been that kind of a snap intuition be wrong. And I really do believe that we know right away. Now, there's books written on the subject, but we oftentimes talk ourselves out of it because it doesn't seem logical. It doesn't seem that that's the right thing based upon our society or our culture or what our partner would like. So we talk ourselves out of it and we justify things. But I'm telling you, if you let yourself go with your instant best judgment, more often than not, you'll be correct.
Is that your experience when you meet people with whom you have relationships? You know immediately.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I have learned to really trust myself that when my spidey senses go off, I pay attention. I pay attention. You have to. Because I work so closely with people that I don't want to work with creepy. I have no interest in creepy. Mm-mm. I want to work with awesome. I want to work with delicious. Because that's what serves my purpose. And we all have our own barometer of what we need and what works for us.
So when you go...
You can laugh, but you know it's true.
No, I'm just laughing because I'm thinking about what I'm about to ask you.
Okay, great. Can't wait.
Yeah, I'm just silly. Okay, so you go into a restaurant. This is good. That's sweet. Nothing to do with meditation or yoga. But so when you go into a restaurant, do you already know whether you want meat or fish or soup or a salad?
Well, since I don't eat meat, I clearly don't want the meat. But unless I go to that restaurant frequently and I already know what my favorite thing is, I go in, I choose the seat I'm going to sit at because it feels comfortable for me to be in that position, and I allow myself to listen to what's being said to me in terms of what the specials are, and I allow myself to scan the menu and see what pops out. Yes.
And I don't want this to be personal at all, but presumably you've had some failed relationships. And,
oh, yes.
And when you met those people with whom you didn't make it.
Jibe, yeah.
Yeah. How did you feel about them the first time you met them?
It depends. Sometimes I've been talked into relationships for a variety of reasons, myself or other people talking me in because it looked good on paper. Okay, so that's note to self. Other times they've been relationships where I've known right away that that was a relationship that I've needed to be involved in, and that was true. I also have had the experience, and I truly do believe that wheels turn. And so my wheel turns at this trajectory, your wheel turns at that trajectory. And for a given period of time, sometimes they look as if they're turning together, and they do. When the wheels start to turn and the sync goes off, you then ride your own path. And so I don't look at any of my relationships as quote-unquote failed. I don't believe they fail. You may each have different things you need to experience now at this time, but the reason you came together was valid, and the reasons you're now coming apart are also valid.
That sounds very adult.
It's true, though.
I don't care if it's true. I'm just telling you.
That's my experience of true. We'll say that much.
It sounds
and,
adult.
Some relationships you don't get to spin out of. So, for example, I will always be with my parents. My mother and my father, we're not going to spin out. Now, we have times where we come closer. We have times when we go further apart, not because of any sort of drama or trauma, but just because that's how the wheel turns.
Yeah, but they're relationships and relationships. I think family relationships and relationships with non-family members are quite different. The response to that, Kristen, is yes, Michael, you're quite right.
Oh, yes, Michael, you're quite right. I don't know.
That's really funny. But I think what you said is absolutely right, is that I think that the reason that relationships don't succeed is exactly what you said. I think that the wheels turn at different whatever. I think that's exactly right. But I'm presuming you don't attribute that to meditation. You're just attributing that to, well, I suppose it is, because your argument would be that you're the person that you are because of meditation and yoga, and therefore you recognize it for that reason, right?
Well, I would say to a certain part of that, but, you know, again, we're still human and we still have our problems, and I know more than anybody else still have my own humannesses and limitations, and I have certainly outlived the statute of limitations on relationships or on circumstances or
on... What does that mean?
Well, so, for example, certain things have a date of expiration, right?
I have no idea.
You need to throw the milk away after a certain date of expiration or it starts to sour.
Well, you got to drink it.
You either drink it or you toss it or you give it to the dog. But clearly, you're not going to want to put it in your coffee. Okay? Yeah. So when it starts to turn, it's up to you to toss it or make it into cheese or give it to the dog or whatever you're going to do with it. But if you keep drinking it, it's on you, the soured milk.
Does your dog like you?
Well, she does. She eats everything. Between my dogs, my chickens, my worms, and the cat, everything gets fed in my house. So I think that you can outlive the usefulness of certain relationships because we are unwilling to let them go because we're afraid. The devil we know is better than the devil we don't. Also, we may not have fully absorbed the lesson, which is why we keep getting hit by the same 2x4, even though we know it's time to move on, but we haven't quite grokked what the lesson is yet. So there's a variety of reasons why we linger in circumstances beyond its, you know, natural turning point. But I think that's why it starts to hurt, is you've got this wheel turning that way and this wheel turning that way, and you're getting stuck in the middle, and it can really tear you up. And so I think being cognizant and recognizing, is this hurting me because I need to evolve and change within the relationship and grow with the confines of what is before me, or is this hurting me because I'm trying to make something work that just clearly is not going to work and I need to be responsible for that?
And you attribute this to the state.
Knowing thyself. Knowing thyself.
Yeah, the state of balance that you've managed to,
yes,
to get.
And you know yourself by listening to yourself and by checking in. And so I will sit down. I'll do my meditation ritual in the morning. I'll light my candles. I'll say my prayers. I'll connect in the ways that I connect. And I will just say, show me, guys. Show me what it is that I am clearly needing to pay attention to. Or let me hear, let me see, and let me be responsive within the course of this day to the impulses, the ideas, and the messages you're giving me. Have you ever driven down the street and you've seen a sign and that sign just perfectly answers what you've needed to say? Or you've turned on the radio and the song playing is exactly what you needed to hear. That, I believe, is being open and responsive to the world around you that's giving you messages all the time that you wouldn't hear if you were so busy in your monkey mind, that your now still meditative mind can absorb and reflect upon.
Let me ask you a stupid question, maybe. So, I now start meditating. What goes through my mind as I'm meditating?
It's not a stupid question at all. There are as many ways to meditate as there are people who do it. So, there's a bunch of different practices. I actually hold a regular meditation group, and in every one of them, I seek to have it be a little bit different, because what Michael will respond to will be different than what Susan will respond to, naturally. Sometimes people like to use a mantra where they repeat the same thing over and over and over again, and that becomes that monotone in the back of their head that allows them to release their thoughts. Other people like to go into the absolute stillness and focus on the void. Other people like to have an object to stare at, like a candle flame. Sometimes people need to do a moving meditation or a chant. There's different ways to do this. Some people like to use guided meditations. As a hypnotherapist, I do a lot of guided meditations. And whenever you want, I'm happy to guide you in the meditation, see what you think about it.
Okay, so here's another stupid question. I've joked over the years that to the extent that I've ever come up with innovative, smart ideas that have really worked, they have invariably come as I stand in the shower.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
And my water bill has gone through the roof. But man, when I get into the shower, my mind turns off and it turns on again, but in a different kind of level. And
that's your meditation there.
Well, there we go. So now I come back to the original question.
Yes.
Can you meditate without knowing you're meditating?
Well, apparently you are, because you're proving it right there. I'm not in the shower with you, dude, but I can tell you that's really common. A lot of people get deep insights when they're in the shower. And the conversation's a couple of different things. A, you're completely relaxed. You're alone. No one's looking at you. You can do whatever you want to do. B, that feeling of the water, of all those little droplets hitting your skin, it's kind of sensory overload on some level. So you go beyond the body and you go into an altered state. It's a really profound experience to transcend the body. And that's exactly what you get to do in that moment. And as well, water in and of itself is a very powerful conductor of energy. We use water sort of in the psychology department, where you're looking at water as being the unconscious, that deep emotional state that we all swim in. So you have all of those different analogies in there. You can pick whichever one works for you.
And the same applies to skiing. You know, I can remember being at the top of a mountain, and you get going, and you're in a state of
communion.
I don't know what you're floating.
Yeah, you're in communion with the mountain in that moment. You're in communion with the breath and the movement and the snow. You're in that sense of all of these different energies working with you. Gravity is pulling you down into the mountain as well as down into the valley. And you have a variety of forces all working at you at once. And you must be in this altered state of awareness, which is not thinking, which is responding appropriately in the moment, in a second, to get you down the mountain. And your heart soars and your body, hopefully it's not in terror, and you begin to enjoy that flying. It's very profound and it's really true. It's the exact same thing.
But it is terror sometimes. I mean, I've never skydived, but a very close friend of mine has a lot. And he's described to me that when he leaves the plane, it's the same deal.
Well, I would imagine that would be terrifying. The plane would need to be on fire for me to leap out of that one.
No, I agree with you totally. To me, this is totally fascinating because, in the last show, I admitted to the fact that I was weird, and I really do believe that I am. You know, I couldn't, in a month of Sundays, listen to people chanting in a room without smiling or just laughing. It's just that there's a funny bone that I have, that would destroy the mood. Many years ago, my ex-wife had a session in our house, where a whole bunch of her friends would stay in a room and chant. And I would come home and I would just giggle, and they hated me for that, and I don't blame them for a moment.
But laughter is really very powerful. And so, I mean, there are actually some practices where laughter is the point. Just laughing.
Well,
that's a powerful thing.
So are you meditating when you're laughing?
I think that when you're meditating, you're beyond thinking.
Oh, well, I'm there all the time. That's not a problem.
So there you go. I would actually say that also, if you look at Tantra, for example, and Tantra doesn't necessarily have to have the sexual connotation. Tantra is about balancing the masculine and the feminine energies. You're coming into that state between these two opposing forces, and you're finding that place that is beyond language, beyond either one of those two energies, to find that third energy that is the between you. And anytime you get to that state where you're beyond thought, beyond words, beyond the body, you're in a meditative state. It's just, it's not the language anymore. It's that sense of full experience.
Kristen, this is really so interesting, because what you've done for me anyway is that you've taken it out of the area of dogma and nuttiness into an area that's totally understandable. And, you know, I now understand the shower experience. I now understand some sexual experiences. I understand skiing down a mountain.
All of them are profound. It's really true. And when you, let's go back to that experience of you with a loved one. It's really profound. If you ever get to that place, and I will wholeheartedly recommend this for your audience. If you and your loved one are in that state of bliss and of union, where you don't know where one stops and the other begins, that is your union. That is your yoga.
So you got to do that a lot, and you'll be in much better state, right?
Oh, you'll be happier. Look, your blood pressure goes down. your union is happier. Your children are happier. You're more productive at work, and you're less time at the doctor's office. I think it's a win-win for everybody.
No, I mean, this really, it really does shine a light because up until this conversation. You know, I'm just a bit of a cynic, and I freely admit to being a little weird, but when I see people do their shtick with meditation, and not yoga, but certainly with meditation, and they evoke memories of guys with strange names and this whole shtick, that's just their way of getting into that state, but there are other ways of getting there.
There's again, just like what you said, there's so many ways of getting there. And you know, and it becomes really easy for us to kind of laugh at people like, oh, I would never do that. But if that's what they need, then God bless them. They're giving themselves what they need.
That's right. But it's not an all or nothing deal. And I think that's the most valuable thing that's come out of this for me is that, you know, I play a lot of tennis. And before that, I did some more strenuous stuff. But you play your most effective tennis when you're in a zone.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're not thinking.
Exactly.
And when you're not thinking, it's exactly the state that you're in when you ski or when you're in the shower or when you are together with your partner or whatever the case is. Your mind switches off and you visualize what you should be doing and you just don't think about it. You just do it.
Exactly. You're in that no time. You ever notice how time just evaporates in it? Suddenly you're like, how did 3 hours go by? That's amazing. That's exactly it. You have altered space and time completely. And you've connected to something bigger than yourself.
I think that many people, and I am one of them, believed, and I say that in the past tense, that you had to have some kind of guy out there with long hair, preferably black, and a black beard, you know, with sandals and something painted on his forehead. You know, it just became too ridiculous for words. But in fact, what that person represents is simply a shower or a ski slope. Or an act of making love, or whatever it is. He is just another form of what you're aiming for. It's really interesting. I think that's very cool.
I'm glad that you have a past tense on before and now have a different perspective.
No, I get it.
You naturally get it. It's beautiful.
No, I get it. You've done great. Okay.
My pleasure.
I think we're done. Thanks a lot.
Anytime.
It's been a real pleasure. I feel, Kristen, a much better person. And I can end this the way I started it, which is when I come back in my next life. And I'm going to be a great yoga, yogi, whatever. That's cool.
Bless.
Next week, guys, I am going to be talking again to my friend Steve Burrows. If you remember, Steve is the world-renowned engineer who has worked for some huge companies. And what we're going to be talking about is that communication thing, which is such an important element in everything we do. So see you next week, guys. If you can't be good, please be careful.
Thank you for tuning in to Dreamers, Winners, and Making a Difference with Michael Friedlander. Please join us again next Monday at 2 p.m. Pacific Time, 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. Until then, Michael encourages you to keep daring to dream and to remember what Nelson Mandela once wrote, namely that a winner is a dreamer who never gives up.